Mas Kowain. Our guests Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld believe they have found three traits shared by cultural and ethnic groups who have become high achievers living in the United States. They say in their new book, The Triple Package, that for example, Indian, Cuban, Nigerian, and Chinese Americans, as well as Mormons and Jews, have a strong belief in their superiority, a feeling of insecurity, which sounds paradoxical, and the ability to control their impulses, to delay gratification and resist temptation. Chua and Rubenfeld acknowledge in their book that there are also downsides to these traits. The book has generated some controversy and some criticism, although not as vociferous as the reaction to Amy Chua's previous book, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Nonetheless, the book raises some really interesting questions about success and achievement. We are joined in the studio by Amy Chua. She's the John M. Duff Professor of Law at Yale Law School. Nice to have you, I should say, back with us on Radio Time. It's been about a decade.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Jed Rubenfeld, and he's the Robert R. Slaughter Professor of Law at Yale Law School. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let's break down these traits, if we could, starting with this idea of superiority. And that is such a strong word, such a loaded word. Amy Chua, what do you mean by that?
You know, it's interesting. We purposely chose the term a superiority complex for the first element, knowing that it is a very ambivalent term. And that's because we did not intend for this book to be this big celebration, right? It's really about the dark sides, too. So what we mean by this term, a superiority complex, is a sense of exceptionality, a sense of being special. And I want to stress, Marty, that this can come from many different sources. It can come from belonging to a certain group, you know, a certain religious group, a certain ethnic group. It can come from belonging to a family, and it can be just a quality that a parent instills in their child. You know, you're special somehow. In the cases we look at, we see just at the group level, we see that the sense of exceptionality can be rooted in religion. You know, for example, the Mormons, very strong chosen people narrative, but also a sense of moral superiority. You know, one Mormon historian described them as an island of morality in a sea of decay, and there are other sources as well.
And there are, as we all know, Jed Rubenfeld, the other side of that is superiority means I'm better than you are, a kind of arrogance that can come with that. I mean, white supremacists think that they're better than anybody else.
Yeah, I would say that the superiority complex might be the most dangerous of the three elements. I mean, throughout history, some of the worst episodes in human history, genocides, holocausts, wars, have been based on superiority complexes. I think, as Amy might be able to tell you better, it's a little different when a minority in a country that is facing prejudice and discrimination has an ethnic pride that can give its members a kind of a shield or an armor, and that makes it sort of feel a little bit better. But in many of the groups that we looked at, you still see this sense of exceptionality, sometimes shading into an intolerance or a prejudice, which often the kids and the second generation, mm-hmm. third generation turn against. And that's one of the great things about America. It teaches the kids to look a little bit skeptically on those claims.
Does superiority come from excessive self-esteem? And I know you're not big into self-esteem, Amy Chua.
Interestingly, it does not. So the way we talk at length about this, we studied these self-esteem studies, and it turns out that most of the studies that are documenting self-esteem actually are not tied to earning self-esteem. So if you know, there are all these studies, and they're like, how do you feel about yourself? Do you feel amazing about yourself, basically? And that's not what we equate with this truly deep sense of exceptionality. You know, for example, in many Chinese and Indian American families, part of the sense of exceptionality is a belief that you're better at school, you're superior at working hard. And the studies are quite fascinating. You know, they actually not only believe that, but that actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You think you're, you know, one of these people that study can do anything. That's very different from unearned self-esteem. You know, which is much more fragile. You know, you're amazing, but you're almost, and the studies actually show that many people who are just kind of pumped up with you're perfect, you're amazing without having to earn it, actually perform less well in school. So we take that exceptionality to be quite different.
Well, what's interesting, and as I said, paradoxical, is that you're really tying this sense of superiority with a feeling of inferiority. And is that a way of sort of tempering this sense of being special or better?
Yes, it really is. And you've got to look at the two qualities together. Either by itself would just have, you know, deleterious effects. Superiority would just make you complacent or smug or belligerent or worse. Insecurity by itself could be paralyzing.
Sure.
or just, you know, make you feel terrible and hide, you know, in your bed all day. But the strange thing that we found, the starting point for the book is that this remarkable fact that in this tough economy with rising inequality, there are these groups out there, it's just a fact, that are doing better on all these conventional metrics, income, educational achievement. So what happened is we first spent a lot of time identifying these groups, and there are literally dozens, although we focus on eight in our book, but we could have written a much longer book. There are tons of others too. Then we looked at the groups and found these cultural qualities that just kind of strike you in the face when you start looking at these groups. So the second one is insecurity, and it's this combination of being of this message being communicated to you that you're capable of great things. That's the exceptionality. But you haven't done them yet. You're not good enough yet. You've got to prove yourself. It's only when you get those two things together, that's the insecurity part, don't feel so great about yourself yet, that you get this drive, this motivation, that's coupled with the high belief in yourself, but this fire, this hunger, because you feel you're not good enough yet. So it's the two together that provide the motivation.
And the third one is this ability to control your impulses, to delay gratification.
Yes. When we looked at these, kind of extremely disproportionately successful groups, we're thinking, what are we going to find? You know, what do Mormons have in common with Iranian Americans? And amazingly, all these groups have this feature in common, that they start imposing much more discipline and self-control and focus on their children at an extremely young age. We knew nothing about the Mormon community. It's so fascinating. But even at preschool age, you know, they are learning to tithe, to take some money to save it, to begin to learn at a young age about fasting. They spend long hours in church services. You know, the mission requirement is very, very, people call it impulse control boot camp. In a lot of the immigrant groups we look at, one study showed that Chinese immigrant preschoolers, okay, these are 3 and 4 year olds, the mothers make their preschoolers spend on average an hour a day on a focused activity. That's, you know, like drawing or just sitting still. An hour a day compared to 6 minutes a day for, you know, just Western, mainstream American parents. And that's, so these are the kinds of early impulse control inculcating behaviors that we discuss.
I mean, it sounds like even beyond traits, which I think sometimes people can associate with perhaps IQ or race, you're really talking about behaviors, what people do.
It's completely about behaviors. There's been so much misunderstanding of this book. If you read our book,
it says traits on the front, but none of that.
But these are behavioral traits. There are behavioral traits too. If you read our book, you'll see that, for example, one of the things we show, and this was really one of the most remarkable findings that we came across in our research. So Asian American kids today, now everybody knows they're doing so well at school, and this is not a stereotype, it's a fact. They score 140 points higher on their SATs on average than the rest of the country. That's, you know, quite remarkable. But when the researchers dug in and they looked at third generation Asian Americans, they found that there was no difference in their academic performance between them, the third generation Asian Americans, and the rest of the country. Now that proves it's not innate. It proves it's not genetic. It proves it's not biological. It's not racial. It's something going on in those first and second generations. And our thought was, can't we be comfortable? Can't we be confident and courageous enough to pull back the curtain, look at what they're doing, talk about this? Because isn't this the kind of thing that maybe we could all learn from? Because I really do want to stress, at the end of the day, although we focus on these groups, the successful groups in America, they change over time. 20 years ago, they were different. 20 years from now, they'll be different. The book is really about individuals. These traits propel success wherever you find them, and they exist in many individuals who aren't from these groups. Many, and they could exist in any given family. So it's not really a book about groups. It's a book about these behavioral traits and outlooks, and they aren't exclusive to any group.
But it seems that your definition of success, and you quote Oliver Wendell Holmes referring to success in his vulgar sense as gaining of money and position, but it seems that is the definition that you're using to define success.
It's really not true. We don't define success that way. What we do is we are looking at groups who are succeeding in that conventional way in terms of income and education. Now, why do we do that? Well, here's my definition of success. It's achieving your goals, whatever they are. Now, with this kind of economic success, material wealth, educational achievement, this is a goal that's important to a lot of people. And it's worth studying to see why some groups are doing better in that way. But, of course, in that very same page that you're looking at, I think we say there's two kinds of educations every person should have.
Right.
They should be taught how to make a living, and they should be taught how to live. Now, these triple package cultures, they are pretty good at number one. They're not so great at number two. And number two, that is so important to a successful life. I mean, learning to be a moral person, a good person, a decent person. And moreover, the qualities we've identified, we're pretty sure they can help and empower people to achieve their goals, whatever they are, whether they decide to be a singer, an artist. And often it happens in these immigrant communities that by the second generation, the kids are looking back at their parents or grandparents saying, you know, we don't want to succeed the way you told us to. We don't accept your expectations. They're getting a little Americanized. They get some of that American individualism. And this is a great thing. In fact, it's one of the aspirational, hopeful things we write about in the book.
But what's interesting to me, and you do acknowledge that there are positive ways to look at these attributes, and then of course, there can be negative consequences. And it seems to me the difference of that is the quality of parenting. I mean, how does a parent transmit these goals and these aspirations to a child, rather than just, you know, standalone superiority or inferiority?
Absolutely. And this is the most, I think, kind of provocative section in our book. So we were talking about insecurity. There are two kinds of insecurity. I mean, there are many sources of insecurity.
Yes.
And part of it is the insecurity of being an outsider. You know, I'm an immigrant. People are making fun of my accent. I don't quite fit in. You know, that is, or I can't, I'm an immigrant. I don't know if I can make it in this country. I'm afraid for my survival. But another form of insecurity, very controversial, that we treat at length, is insecurity created within the family. This is, let me put it starkly. This is basically parents making their children feel that they are not good enough yet. And in very different ways, all of these disproportionately successful groups we look at kind of instill this feeling in their children. And we mean this as a two-edged sword. I mean, what kind of parent wants to make their child not feel good enough? We're very upfront about this. And what, for example, it's also the opposite, by the way, of the self-esteem movement, that you're perfect as you are, you know. So in the Asian immigrant families. And we define what we mean by Asian immigrant. We really chiefly are looking at Korean, Vietnamese, Chinese, East Asian families for these studies. But it is there are studies that show, first of all, that parents in these groups, impose exorbitantly high academic expectations. So the joke, why only a 99, not 100? That's, you're not good enough yet. On top of that, their studies also show that East Asian immigrant parents much more frequently compare their kids to other successful kids. So-and-so's kid just got into Harvard, so-and-so. And that's, again, other people are doing better than you.
Mm.
And that can be an unpleasant feeling as well, you know, especially if it's tied to family honor. So food for thought.
That's Amy Chua. And she joins us along with her husband, Jed Rubenfeld. And we're talking about their new book called The Triple Package. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
Starting in the 1950s, African Americans on the radio began changing the country.
We were the little engine that could, and we were going to fight the big guys.
They had a sound you couldn't hear anywhere else.
Ooh, tiddly off, let's make way for the jock. Look, pull all through, later, Gator. Got a cut. Hello there, Douglas.
I'm Kenny Gamble. Tune in for Going Black, the legacy of Philly Soul Radio.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Vladimir Putin has been hobnobbing with world leaders, confabbing with Team USA. Did Putin win a gold at the Games? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld. They are both professors of law at Yale Law School and co-authors of this new book called The Triple Package, about behaviors they have observed in specific cultural and ethnic groups who have done well in the United States. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscow-Wayne if you have any questions or comments for our guests. We are, though, in many ways talking about immigrants. I mean, immigrants coming to the United States, and I'm assuming that's kind of a self-selecting group. They come here because they want to get out of their country of origin. They come here because they do want something, perhaps for themselves or for their children. So I'm assuming the kind of character traits that we're talking about, or even some of the behaviors, really just underscore the immigrant ethos, and I'm looking at you.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that, and you know, for hundreds of years, sociologists have observed this about the immigrant groups who have come to America, whether it's the Irish Americans, the Italian Americans, Polish Americans, or before them, the Protestants who built this country. Every time, the first and second generations experience exceptional upward mobility. And in a way, that's what our book's about. You know, can we capture that formula? What if we could bottle that? Because how does it happen? Now, if your point, though, is, listen, Jed, I think I can explain what you're observing through immigrant self-selectivity.
Mm-hmm. There, I've to got some degree, I am.
Yeah, I've got to say you may be exaggerating something that's kind of a stereotype. Like we have a stereotype of Asian immigrants coming in with, you know, high-status jobs or high education. It's just not true. So more than half of Chinese immigrants come over not with educational or employment visas. Instead, they're poor and poorly educated. Also, don't forget that two of our cases are Mormons and
right.
Jews. These are
right.
not immigrant communities.
Right.
Yet we're seeing the same cultural pattern in all these groups. And let me just finish about the Chinese. So their kids, and this has been very well studied, the kids of these, we're talking about dry cleaners in Korean cases, actually, but restaurant workers in Chinese cases more stereotypically, but the kids of factory workers, in short, menial jobs, not well off and poorly educated, their kids are just blowing it out of the park academically. They do just as well as the higher educated Asian immigrants, but much more important than that, they're doing better than the kids of more privileged, better educated white parents. And this is the key phenomenon. Our book is not a book that compares that group to, let's say, inner city African Americans. Everyone's reading it that way. That's not what we're saying. I mean, you don't need to write a book to say why that kind of group, these Asian immigrants who are coming, are doing better than a group that's been subject to 250 years of slavery exclusion, structural bias. That's not what we're saying. We're focusing on the fact that they're performing better, their kids, than the kids of better-off white parents, and that's the fascinating phenomenon which you cannot explain through immigrant selectivity, even if you say they're coming over with more drive. How did they pass that on to their kids? That's the question. Mm. How is the transmission mechanism going for the parents to the kids? That's what our book's about.
Well, let me pick up on that, and let's just take the, you know, the wasps that arrived on the Mayflower. I mean, are you saying that, broadly speaking, I'm a wasp, so I can say this, that broadly speaking, you know, wasp culture has sort of lost this sense of this mix of superiority, inferiority, the third one was just
impulse control.
Yeah. Yes,
we spend a lot of time. I think that the wasps, if you want to call them, are the original triple package. In a way, we have a fun section on Max Weber because, you know, you think of the Calvinist that was the elect. That's really superior chosen people, and insecurity. Part of their doctrine was that the only way we can show that we're the elect is we don't know, you know, but we have to just keep working and working, and so massive impulse control. But we didn't really develop this in our book because others already have. There are tons of books that show how in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the, let's call it, you know, the elite WASP establishment, in our terms, basically lost their insecurity because they, you know, and this is just natural human behavior. You're not afraid you're going to starve. The reason immigrants feel so insecure is they don't even know if they can survive. So when you're a little bit more comfortable, and that's when, you know, you see these immigrants, and with the Civil Rights Act, and finally, and there are quite a lot of academic studies showing how when Jews were finally, the quotas were lifted, just a big shift even in the Ivy Leagues and Wall Street and the, you know, so in that sense. Now, our book is very dynamic. No group ever stays. You know, in fact, the very fact of a decline in a group could be a new reason for insecurity. So, you know, I mean.
But are you telling us, you know, think like an immigrant? I mean, that if you want to be, quote unquote, successful, perhaps think like an immigrant?
Well, again, two of our main groups are not immigrants,
right.
Mormons and Jews. I really want to emphasize that. But in a way, I wouldn't mind if you put it that way, because I'll say it. You know, again, we have known for over 100 years that somehow second-generation immigrant kids, so these are not the ones who came over, the second generation, experience exceptional upward mobility. And we know this, and yet we're uncomfortable talking about groups and group differences in this country. But our feeling was, now, why should we be afraid to talk about it? What if it is true that these immigrants and certain other groups too, Mormons and Jews, even though they're third, fourth, fifth-generation Americans, are putting some kind of special charge into their kids, where the kids feel they're capable of great things, but they feel if they don't, you know, work hard and achieve and strive, they're going to be disappointing either their parents or themselves or something like that. What if we could unpack this formula and make it available, because maybe we could all learn from it.
But I want to add to that what I think is the most important study in our book. It's, I'll call it the reverse marshmallow test. So I think everybody knows the famous marshmallow test. It's all about impulse control. You know, you offered, there was a study where they offered a child, a whole bunch of kids, one marshmallow now, or you can wait 15 minutes and you'll get two marshmallows. And it turns out that the kids who could defer gratification and wait the 15 minutes, when you track them 30 years later, they were wildly more successful in education and income and health. Well, recently at the University of Rochester, they reran this test with a new twist. First, with half the kids, they lied to them. Okay, they said, if you do this, we will give you these cool art supplies. And then they broke their promise. They didn't deliver. So then they ran the marshmallow test. You want, you know, one marshmallow now, or do you want to wait 15 minutes? All the kids who had been lied to grabbed the first marshmallow.
Sure.
And my point there is that this goes to our more disadvantaged groups in this country. If you are somebody that doesn't trust the system, if you don't believe that your hard work really will be rewarded because people will break their promises, then of course you have no incentive to do this triple package thing. So some of our biggest support, by the way, has come from educators. You know, I've had lots of people sending me these articles saying, it's weird that this is so controversial, because we have had such bad luck transforming education policy in this country. But if we could take some of these ideas, not just, oh, simplistically, you got to have more impulse control, but some people don't. Immigrants come from other countries and they believe in the system more. That, you know, maybe because they come from more terrible, more corrupt, more violent places, and they somehow trust our system. So, you know, if we have to, in order to motivate people, we need to, how do we create the incentives? How do we instill drive? And, you know, but our point is that looking at some of these behaviors that lead to more academic success shouldn't be off the table as a taboo topic.
What about things like, I don't know, whether curiosity, risk-taking, resilience? I mean, I'm thinking of all the other qualities that probably play some kind of role in someone's academic or career success.
You're absolutely right. And, I mean, let's just say we don't have all the answers, and we're not trying to say the triple package covers, you know, every possible great quality in the world. We just think we've identified three traits that are helping a lot of people succeed. But I will say, on the point you raised, there's something kind of dynamic and interesting and liberating about the collision between these traditional values and cultures and America. So the kids come in, and they're being raised by their parents, being told, you must be a doctor, you must do this, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of innovation or curiosity maybe in it. Then you combine that with American individualism, rebelliousness, questioning authority, and this great thing happens where the kids get that curiosity. They decide, well, we're not so sure. We accept what the parents are saying. And that is part of why you see so many of these first or second generation kids breaking off and doing new and often artistic things, but they could be entrepreneurial as well. So many of Silicon Valley startups have been founded by children of immigrants and in just this kind of a path-breaking way. But also we talk about examples of artists, filmmakers, and authors in our book.
But are they rebelling against their parents, or they're just becoming Americans?
I think partly both. I mean, you were talking about some of the costs. You know, we've been criticized about this our definition of success. But I think if you read the book, it's kind of the opposite, because what we say is that because of this form of insecurity that, you know, is in the triple package that generates this, I need to show everybody mentality. I need to prove it to my parents. I need to prove it to my society. You know, in the case of the Mormons, we have to show America. That can often lead into very conventional, typical, prestige-oriented success. That, you know, like you have to be respected, you have to be a lawyer. You know, you can't be a jazz musician, you have to be a doctor, you have to get a PhD. And that, we say, can be extremely imprisoning if it's not what you want. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have this amazing story. We talk about Ang Lee. After he got Best Director at the Oscars, right? Everybody, oh my God, Brokeback Mountain, so revolutionary. His father said, you know, now that you're still young, maybe now you can become an academic, you know. So, and Ang Lee writes about never feeling good enough. And we are quite serious that this is something, this is not a how-to book, right? I mean, it's just like, is this a good feeling?
Well, one thing that Ang Lee does is he says, I am not going to raise my children the way my parents or my father raised me.
And Amy Tan had a very similar thing. She said, it felt horrible. I felt like I could never please my parents. So we kind of lay it all out there. Vera Wang, who's kind of my idol, you know, designs wedding dresses, says the same thing. She says she always sees not what she hasn't done good enough. But I think it's actually important to not romanticize the other side. Happiness is very elusive, right? So it may not be happiness producing to feel that you're not good enough all the time, but it's also not happiness producing to not be able to get the job you want or to have a passion, but nobody will hire you for that passion. So, you know, in a way, the book is a kind of a meditation on what it means to be driven and the costs of that, as opposed to just a celebration.
And that's Amy Chua, who joined us along with Jed Rubenfeld. We are talking about their new book. It's called The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. Both of our guests are law professors at Yale Law School. And again, we're taking emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Let me quote something you write at the very end of the book. The Triple Package, using your description, doesn't promise a meaningful life, but it does make such a life possible because it allows people to seize the reins of time to live not only in the present, but also for the future, to devote their full capacities to changing themselves or the world in small ways or large. And I was just struck by that it doesn't promise a meaningful life.
Well, you know, first, I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. There's material success, then there's happiness, then there's meaning. These are all different things, and there can be trade-offs between them. I mean, some people can make a lot of money and, as we know, not be happy. Boy, anybody who equated making money with happiness would, you know, obviously be making a really colossal mistake. But it is interesting about culture. One of the things culture does is it orients people in time. What I mean by that is, like, some cultures are going to tell their members, you must venerate the past, keep the past no matter what. That's a kind of traditional culture. Then there are other cultures that will say, you must live in a certain way for the future. Then there are other cultures that will emphasize to the members, live in the moment, live in the now. In my view, American culture has moved a little bit toward that last point. That is,
live in the now?
Yeah, it encourages us to live in the moment, a little bit more focused on instant gratification. Now, in a way, you know, we'd all love to live in the moment. That's great. But what triple package cultures do is they allow people the ability and the orientation to say, here's something I want to achieve in the future. And it might be difficult, but I'm going to set myself to it. I'm going to forgo some present satisfaction and really work hard to it. I'm going to get up when they knock me down 12 times and keep trying. And, you know, no matter what your goals are, whether it's to get a certain job or to be an artist or whatever it is, that kind of future-oriented dedication and resourcefulness and resilience, that's going to help you. And so what we're saying at the end of the book is, these qualities can really help people engage themselves over time to live the kind of life they want to. And to me, that is what a meaningful life, to live the kind of, to write your own script, to live the life that you define for yourself.
You say, here's what America likes to tell Americans. Everyone is equal, feel good about yourself, live in the moment, as you were just saying. But America also has this other part where we say, you know, we are exceptional. There's never been a country like America in the world. I've heard mostly political leaders, but others say that as well. We're this very, I think, odd assortment of beliefs and values.
Yeah, our last chapter is different because, you know, when you talk about it's tricky enough talking about groups, and we have lots of caveats. Of course, we're not talking about every single member, but we talk about a nation. But, you know, we kind of engage in this thought experiment, and in a sense, we say that America was born a triple package country for just the reasons you say. This sense of American exceptionalism is such a familiar trope. City on the hill, you know, we were born, we're our system of democracy is better than Europe's. For most of our history, we had the insecurity of being an underdog. You know, we were ragtag colonies, then there was the Soviet Union. We were always trying to prove ourselves and impulse control the Puritan, you know, and Ben Franklin. But to your point, What we say at the end is, after the fall of the Soviet Union, for the first time in our history, we had no rival. Mm-hmm. And part of that, we maybe lost a little bit of the insecurity that we've always had. And what we also say provocatively is, superiority complex alone, without being tempered by some insecurity and impulse control, is just swagger. And that,
well, I would say, yeah. 9/11 took care of that, don't you think?
And, you know, the financial crisis. So, you know, nobody wants to revel in tragedy. But it's a little bit, right. I think you could view our book as slightly with an optimistic slant. The rise of China, people are a little bit on their toes. Like, you know, we need to, we've always been at our best when we had to prove our mettle. And
do you think of yourselves as driven? I ask that knowing you wrote this book about the Tiger Mother. I'm going to ask you that.
Well, that's like asking me whether, you know, I think of myself as a triple package person. I can tell you for sure, I know I bring insecurity to the table. But other than that, I'm not quite sure about the other qualities. I did just want to add to the point that Amy was making. You know, at the end of the book, we do talk about, should America have the aspiration to be a triple package country? And there, the critical thing is, what's the content of the superiority complex? Because a national superiority complex,
what do you feel so good about?
Yeah,
right?
It could be belligerent, it could be arrogant, it could be jingoistic. And of course we know that through the centuries, sometimes America's sense of exceptionality has veered off in that direction, or with a racial tinge to it too. What we're saying is, wait, there's always been another threat of American exceptionality, a superiority or an exceptionality based on tolerance, equality, inclusiveness. If we can take that to be the basis of our feeling of exceptionality, then that's one worth aspiring to.
We're almost up in a break, but isn't that what immigrants come to the country for, Amy Chu? I mean,
yeah.
We're speaking for all immigrants here, but isn't that?
I think so.
And even the instant gratification that this country offers as well.
Ironically, right? And so you know, and this is a nice point. It's a misunderstanding to see our book as a celebration of just the first generation. It really is about the collision of these triple package cultures with American individualism and success itself, right? Because each of these qualities gets eroded with more and more success. You get more comfortable, you feel less insecure. You feel less insecure, you're less disciplined. I feel this in my own household with my daughters, you know, and you get less hungry. And that's not just good or bad, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're trying to tease out.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I have some emails I want to read as well. And again, Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld are guests, and their book is called The Triple Package, subtitled How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America. And we're talking about this sense of superiority, this sense of inferiority. I'm getting myself all bollocksed up here, and a sense of focus and direction. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, an enchanted tale that has delighted generations. The Philadelphia Orchestra under Stéphane Deneuve performs Stravinsky's The Firebird, plus music from Prokofiev's Cinderella, all featuring premier dancers from Philadanko on the stage. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999 today. February 28th and March 1st at the Kimmel Center, The Firebird with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm going to do these four cons to get us out of this. Not just me, but us.
American Hustle has been nominated for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for David O. Russell. He was also nominated for Best Director for his two previous films, Silver Linings Playbook and The Fighter. We talk with David O. Russell on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Bankers After Hours.
What do these two people have in common, Ted?
I'd say they're big titans on Wall Street.
No, they're future cellmates.
Inside the new face of banking, millennials confront the finance industry and discover it's not for everybody. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Jed Rubenfeld and Amy Chua. Amy Chua is the John F. Duff Professor of Law at Yale Law School. Jed Rubenfeld, the Robert R. Slaughter Professor of Law, also at Yale Law School. They happen to be married to each other and have co-authored this book we're talking about called The Triple Package. And we have calls coming in at one. No, we don't. We have no calls coming in, but we have an email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moscowane. In fact, we have a tweet from Lee, what are their thoughts on the second generation of African-American college grads? My experience has been very similar. Do you want to take that, Jed?
We found in doing research for the book that one of the groups just hitting out of the park academically in this country are African-Americans who are the children of and immigrants from a variety of countries. So Jamaica, Haiti, Ghana. But the most prominent of these are Nigerian Americans. And first and second generation Nigerian Americans are so wildly disproportionately represented in some of our best schools on Wall Street. We give the statistics for Harvard Business School. This is not our finding. Other people have noticed this before. And it's one of the remarkable things. Again, it shows that what we're talking about has nothing to do with race, nothing to do with skin color. It, again, makes you ask the question, okay, let's look behind the curtain. Let's see what's happening in those families, in those groups, in those cultures, because this is something, you know, every single family could try to do if it wanted. Nobody has to, you know, aspire to these qualities or you know, be interested in educational achievement or making money. But if people are, here's how it's being done.
But does it also tell us about history? I mean, if you're talking about immigrants coming, let's say, from Nigeria, coming to this country, a very different history from homegrown African-Americans.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we try to stress this so much in our book that if you ask us what are the reasons that our most disadvantaged groups are disadvantaged, our inner cities, the poorest communities, we would say, of course it's history. Of course it's a history of slavery and exclusion and repeated discrimination, macroeconomic changes that wiped out jobs for an entire, you know, community. So, and those are just problems that we have to acknowledge, you know, and we have to address those. Now, it doesn't mean, however, I mean, I guess there's just almost a tendency to say that if it's that, then, you know, we shouldn't talk about other behaviors at all, you know, because you're going to be blaming these groups. And we just feel like it's got to be possible to talk about both, because if you say there is nothing that any poor group can do but except for wait for discrimination and, you know, history to be corrected, there's no agency. There's nothing that an individual family or a parent can do. And we're saying for some of these things, you know, maybe we can learn from some of these other groups.
Let me quote something from Slade, and I don't have my own unique knowledge to know whether this is true or not. This is about Nigerians and what you say in your book. Nigerians get advanced degrees in no small part because they need to stay in school to retain their visa. The idea is why are they so highly represented in some of these schools is because in order to stay in the country, they need a visa, and that's how they stay in school.
Yeah, I think that's really very unfair. We looked at a lot of studies, and we actually conducted our own. For example, it took us a long time to analyze Harvard Business School and Harvard Medical School. We looked at the Black Student Associations. We had to do surveys. And I can tell you that it's really not giving them their due. You know, of course. I mean, of course that's part of it, right? But to say that that's the whole – really – It's such a great example of the way that of our thesis. So many, just take the Nigerians. Most of the Nigerians in this country, the vast majority, belong to the Igbo or Yoruba groups. These are groups that in Nigeria have proud lineages. In their Yoruba case, kind of a royal lineage, very strong sense of exceptionality, and they were disproportionately successful there. So they do come, you know, with a head start. But they arrive in this country and they run smack into American racism, right? So the history doesn't automatically change. They are stop and frisk. They are no matter how successful they are, they face different sometimes denied jobs despite their qualifications. And it's that can have very, very negative effects, but one effect that it can sometimes have is to generate this drive and almost like a resentment that we discussed, this kind of a feeling of, wait a minute, you combine the sense of exceptionality with suddenly being looked down on, and a lot of the groups we talk about have this, and that can be like, we're going to show you, you know, we're going to work 10 times as hard.
Here's another criticism from the same article on Slate. It's not just that Mormons have developed a, quote, pioneer spirit, or that they believe they can receive divine revelations, as Triple Package would have us believe. It's more than the first Mormon started with enough money to buy land in Missouri and Illinois. And she goes on from there.
Well, you know,
I think the point is that if you have some wherewithal or some money, if you have parents with some degree of education or some aspirations for those kinds of education, then that's another kind of, I guess, triple package, and then throw in some land.
But I will talk about the Mormons very quickly, because I'll let you know. There's been an outpouring from Mormon historians on that particular point, that's just not true. The Mormons were extremely poor and persecuted. They had an extermination order against them.
I just want to say there is this tendency to disparage these groups who have succeeded. And I think there might be some kind of good intention behind it. Maybe the person writing that had the following intention. You know, I should disparage these groups that have succeeded. I should deny that they've, you know, worked hard and achieved these things, because that way I'll be preserving the feelings of some other people and I won't be insulting them. You know, but this effort to kind of undercut, first, it's just factually false. So the Mormons were chased across the country with nothing. They were penniless. They were chased across the country under an extermination order from Illinois. When they got to Utah, they had nothing. And the ones who have so you got the example of Mitt Romney in your head, so that's a stereotype, because you know that his parents were wealthy. The fact is that about 9 out of 10 of the Mormons who are, you know, doing so well in business these days, and it's really extraordinary how well they're doing in business, and it's a development of the last 30 years. It's really quite remarkable, and we discussed this, and our theory can account for it. Nobody else's theory can. It's not immigrant. It's not genetic. But if you look at them, about 9 out of 10 started from very humble origins. Their parents, not well educated. Mormonism has not stressed this high, you know, academic culture. They've started colleges and schools in many places, but it's not, a deep, you know, scholarly tradition. And so their parents were not so well educated. They were of humble working class origins. So it's just false to say that. And about the Nigerians, well, you know, sorry, but let's look at all the groups we're talking about. You can't, when these East Asian Americans come over, poor, barely literate, and their kids are, so it's Stuyvesant High School in New York City. It's one of the best high schools in the country. It's free, it's examination only to get in, and over 70% of the kids there now are Asian Americans. It's just a almost shocking percentage. And of those kids, a third to half or more are the kids of poor and poorly educated parents. We can try to bury our heads in the sand. We can be told, look, if you say that the reason why Asian American kids are doing better academically is because of their study habits, that's cultural racism. Okay, that's what some people are saying. It also happens to be true. And if you want to bury your head in the sand, you can, but I think that's just tying your hands behind your back. We won't learn how to address poverty. We won't learn how to address inequality. We'll be denying information to people who might want it. So I think it's time to look at these facts more in the face.
And what you're saying is true is that they work harder. Is that what you're saying? They
work harder. They have different study habits. They have a different outlook toward educational achievement. They're told by their parents that you can achieve. And this has been found in studies, sociological studies of different immigrant communities. They're told by their parents that they're given high expectations. What are high expectations? You're being told simultaneously, you can achieve, you can do better than everybody else. But don't sit back. If you don't achieve, you'll be disappointing us. You'll be disappointing yourselves. And, you know, to me, that's a traditional American value. It's not a foreign thing. It's telling your kids, and I'm no parenting expert, but, you know, you got to buck up if you don't do this. And it could just be chores. If you don't do this, if you don't do that, it's to have some expectations of them, which you demand that they fulfill. And if they don't, they understand that then they shouldn't feel so great about themselves.
But do you feel, Amy Chua, as because you wrote Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, and I know you feel like you were misunderstood in that book, and I hear from both of you, and I read a lot of the criticisms and reviews of this book, that you're also misunderstood in this book. I mean, do you feel like what you're trying to tell America does not understand?
Yeah, I think this is such a fascinating and subtle book. You know, even in the very title, it's about the rise and fall, you know, of groups. Even in the three terms we chose, we could have made this sugarcoating, right? We could have called it, here's what you need for success, confidence and grit and big dreams, you know. Instead, we choose these really loaded terms for a reason, because I think that drive has a price. And I know, you know, the studies bear this out. And we spend almost half the book exploring the underside, the psychological underside. But nor is this, I think it's actually too dismissive to say, oh, we should absolutely not do any of this, right? Because it's, again, happiness is very elusive. We all want to do the best for our children. And for us, this is almost just like, let's try to put as much factual information out there. And what's the relation between this and Battle Hymn is, I had split emails from Battle Hymn. Half the people were like, oh my God, this is exactly how I grew up. I don't even get what people are upset about. This is me. And other people were shocked. Like, and so I realized that people don't know what goes on inside these subcultures. You know, like, this is the way they parent. And we learned so much about the Mormon community, studying all these, you know, I had no idea this is how they raise their children. And to me, these are facts that we can either debate or, but let's make, they're interesting.
Well, and I was one of those people, frankly, that was shocked as I read about it. I mean, just I think your parenting style is very different from mine, and whether one is better than the other, whether there's a different kind of outcome. But, you know, when you let people into your family life, which you did, people are going to judge, and they're going to make they're going to criticize you.
Of course. And that's we ask for it, right? Absolutely. And family and parenting is a very, very sensitive subject.
Yep.
And I mean, I feel like in the end that it was a bad, you know, first 3 months before people had actually read the book. But when people did read it, even people who very much disagreed with me, because when you get to the end, you realize that my younger daughter rebels, my sister gets cancer, it becomes a much more contemplative, what is the right thing to do? I got emails from people saying, you know, sorry, I'm the one that sent you that hate mail on Amazon. But it's just all about we're struggling. We're struggling to try to do the right thing.
And what was your experience of that book?
Well, it was very tough at first because, you know, to be honest, I think a lot of people jumped on it before they had read it. They read something about it. They saw a headline. They saw a review by someone else who hadn't read it. So there was a period of it was really rough for the family, and I worried about Amy. But I just felt that, you know, the message had not come through of how much Amy loves her daughters and how much they love her. And in part, that's because you wrote the book to be funny and amusing and to be extreme in the opening chapters, with the contemplative and searching part coming at the end. And a lot of people just looked at the first couple of chapters and thought they thought it was like a how-to book, and it just wasn't.
Well, and the Wall Street Journal title was Why Chinese Mothers Are Superior.
Horrible.
But you're also talking about superiority in this book. I mean, and again, as we began, this is a loaded word.
Well, you know, it's a superiority complex. So it's not as loaded as you think. Like, people who haven't read this book are saying, they're saying some groups are superior. That's backwards. We are saying that some groups are doing very well right now, but those groups will change, right? The traits the behaviors we focus on are constant. The groups that succeed will change. But a superiority complex, I mean, that term is quite negative. So it is not saying that the groups are superior. It's like there's a little bit of a problem here. There's some intolerance. And we talk at the end of the book about how the American sense of ideally for us, American exceptionality should be based on tolerance, how that tends to always triumph over the group's intolerance, and that's part of the beauty of America. You know, like people come in, ethnic pride shades very quickly into intolerance.
May I just say, just to be crystal clear about it, a lot of people jumped on this book early on before it had been published and said, oh, they're saying that some groups are better than others. I mean, that headline was plastered all over the social media. We are saying some groups are doing better than others in totally conventional metrics, which nobody has to be interested in, but in terms of educational achievement money. To say that some groups are doing better, that's a matter of fact. You can look it up in the U.S. Census. If we're at the point where, you know, citing U.S. Census statistics gets you accused of racism or stereotyping, we're in trouble. And that is not to say that any group is better than anybody else.
We had Paul Tough on the show. He wrote a book called How Children Succeed. And there's some parallels, I think, to what you're saying, but he also talks about perseverance, curiosity, conscientiousness, optimism, self-control. And those, to me, are little friendlier, can we say, than superiority, inferiority, and there is self-control there.
I know. I feel like, you know, what? those are nicer terms. And, you know, we had different intentions. I mean, I think one thing that people don't talk about in all these books about success and, you know, cultures is drive. That's what I think is actually, you know, when people say, oh, the Cubans came over, they had been doctors in their country. Of course that's important. But what they're missing is, what is the transmission mechanism? So they come here. They can't be doctors here. They were confiscated. They have $5. They're living 12 people in a tiny apartment. There are no Cubans and no dog signs up. They are poor. How do they get their children? You know, it's not like there's a magic gene. I was a doctor, so now you're. And for me, that's what people are missing, right? And that's the question that I think is interesting. We all, as parents, even people very different from this Tiger Mom thing, I think we all want our children to be inspired and motivated. You know, whether it's to do public service, right? Nobody wants a bored and unmotivated child. And we are trying to approach drive in a very honest way, because I think honestly, to be driven, something has to be missing. Something has to be pushing you. Otherwise, you wouldn't feel like you had to work more and more, right? So I think it's kind of an honest book, which is partly why we chose such ambivalent terms.
If I could add just one thing about this.
10 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, this triple package business is the opposite of getting kids to feel entitled. I don't think kids grow up happy if they feel entitled, if they feel like they're great without earning stuff. And so I think if you raise kids that way too much, that's also a problem.
Well, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called The Triple Package, and it's written by our guests, Amy Chua, and Jed Rubenfeld, and they are both law professors at Yale Law School. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.